Flight 365, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 7 of The New Normal. On today's episode, we'll be discussing aspects of and solutions for effectively providing care to underserved populations. We have a diverse panel that will highlight how their organizations are addressing the access to care, filling gaps in care, and reaching underserved communities, addressing social determinants of health, leveraging data to enhance care, and more. I want to take a minute to thank our panelists for joining us today and sharing their valuable time. I would also like to thank our attendees for your interest in The New Normal and joining us today. As for the structure of the webinar, attendees will be on mute and will be reserved time for questions. Please place your questions within the Q&A. You can review the recording of today's webinar on www.newnormal.buzz. So I just want to go into a little bit of background. The Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, characterizes underserved and vulnerable populations as communities that include members of minority populations or individuals who have experienced health disparities. While underserved communities have limited access to healthcare services, vulnerable consumers tend to experience additional barriers to getting care. Some examples of individuals within those populations include older adults, individuals living in rural locations, racial and ethnic minorities, low-income individuals, or persons experiencing homelessness. By learning about the challenges these populations face, the right technology and care solutions can make a big impact on the lives of those who need the most help and move us towards a healthcare system that is more effective for everyone. Our panelists today are leaders in healthcare, innovators, and are building solutions that work for the underserved, vulnerable, and chronically ill in our society. Now I want to introduce our distinguished panelists that will provide insight on how they are addressing these issues within their organization. First, I want to introduce Susan Kortz. Susan is the CEO and founder of Catalytic Health Partners. Catalytic Health Partners focuses on helping individuals who otherwise may be underserved by more traditional care delivery. Susan is defining how integrated healthcare for our most vulnerable populations can be delivered to address the most common causes of health and well-being through a laser focus on solving for social and behavioral needs ahead of physical medicine. Susan is a serial entrepreneur and has been the CEO and founder of multiple companies, which have created new ways to provide solutions in healthcare and other industries through predictive analytics and proprietary technologies. Prior to starting Catalytic Health Partners in 2014, Susan participated in healthcare industry investments, as well as an advisor to multiple companies. She has an extensive international business experience and more than 30 years of healthcare senior management experience. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
Yeah. Next is, here. Thank you. And great to have you here as well. Next is Tom Leggett. Tom is the Director of Business Development for Sonora Quest Labs. He has more than 20 years of award-winning experience in medical sales management and business development. Tom works across collaboratively with industry partners to support innovative projects throughout the Arizona healthcare systems. During the pandemic, Tom integrated guidance from the Arizona Department of Health Services with Sonora Quest's dependable testing capabilities to lead and facilitate efforts to conduct testing at K-12 schools, community events across the state, long-term care, assisted living, and the Arizona Department of Corrections facilities. Tom holds a master's degree in exercise physiology, kinesiology, and exercise science from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He also is a nationally registered EMT paramedic. I always forget that about you. Welcome, Tom, and thanks for being here as well. So, yeah, you're welcome. So to provide a little context, I'm going to ask the panelists to briefly share some information about their role in the organization. So, Susan, why don't you kick it off and let us know about the mission of Catalytic Health Partners. I'll talk about Life 365. And what is your why? Why did you start Catalytic Health Partners?
Yeah, so awesome. Thank you, Ken. I started Catalytic Health Partners because I felt like healthcare, you know, really did not meet the needs of everybody in the healthcare ecosystem. And it was a bit upside down. So healthcare is really the only industry I know of in which we tell customers what customers are going to do to engage with us, and we tell them what's best for them instead of listening to them and hearing what they have to say. And realizing that this did not meet the needs of especially some of our most underserved populations, I developed, you know, Catalytic Health Partners to say, hey, there's a different way, there's a different approach. And if we go at this differently, we can make a huge difference. So we serve highly underserved populations. So people who typically are on Medicaid plans, who are the highest risk, highest cost, highest needs individuals. We do it in their homes in a cross-functional team that consists of therapists, nurse practitioners, care coordinators, what we call clinical liaisons, as well as social workers, all working with individuals in their home environment, learning what their desires are as the member, for them giving us guidance about what their goals are in life and how we meet them. We start first and foremost with their social needs, because we realize that health is really about us as humans. It's not really about a diagnosis. And many of those things are driven by our social needs and total context of what's going on. And when you solve for those social needs and behavioral health needs, our physical health concerns are actually pretty minuscule.
That's awesome. So where do you get your patients from, right, from this? Who are you working with to help with their populations?
That's a great question. Members. So we work directly with health plans that, so they're HMO plans that cover Medicaid populations. And we work with them to define what, you know, their target market is for us to address, whether, you know, we have a range of the top 1-3%. So we're in that range, meets their needs as well, because obviously this is a partnership. So we're partnering with them to outreach to these individuals. We are an opt-in only program. So we don't do assignments. So it's not like they're giving us assignment for our members. We reach out to them, allow them the opportunity to say, yes, I'd like to have additional help. And they are then providing Catalytic Health Partners assistance.
So I obviously want to dig deeper into this, but I'll come back to you in just a few minutes. But Tom, let's go over to you and talk about your why. You're at Snoring Quest Laboratories. You know, what's your mission at SQL?
Well, I can tell you my roles and responsibilities, not necessarily my why, I'll get that to in a second, but the roles and responsibilities that I have are generally to try and look at the healthcare market, see where the trends are going, and make sure that we have the solutions in place to meet the future. And a lot of that does have to do with my why, which is making sure that we can provide improved access to the patients that we serve, give them a great experience when they come to Sonora Quest. And the same thing goes for the providers, right? We want to make sure that basically we're taking all of the hassle out of it for a provider when they need to order labs on their patients, that they can do that. The patient is compliant because we have great access to care. They get their labs done and we get those results back to that provider in a timely fashion. And they can utilize those reports to change management of those patients in a positive direction. And so I think in general, I'm doing my job because I love taking care of the patients. I love making sure that people don't have any type of a barrier to improved access, that they can get where they're going, or for that matter, now the trend is we go to them in one way, shape, or form to get their labs drawn or any additional services they might require while we're in their homes.
Yeah, so if most people don't know, or some people don't know, Sonora Quest is a joint venture between Banner Health and between Quest Diagnostics, right? Right. One of the things that was interesting, I'll just share a personal observation, is that, you know, I went in for a 6-month checkup with my PCP, with my primary care physician. He is going to total concierge service, right? He's going to stop accepting insurance and he wants to go totally to concierge. And part of the thing he said to me is, what can I change to better serve you? And I said, well, first of all, it's unnecessary for me to come visit you, right? In the first place, especially on a 6-month visit. And he said, well, I need to have lab tests and results done. I'm like, then schedule that a week in advance. Sonora Quest can come out to my home and take a blood draw. And by the time we do a virtual visit back and forth, you know, I've already got blood pressure sitting here. I can give you my spot blood pressure I need to. You can already have the results in your EHR, you know, for me, and we could do a very qualitative visit, you know, back and forth instead of trying to get it all rushed that day, right, or the day before that day. And I think that seems to be very eye-opening. Are you starting to see trends that there's more people like myself that are out there, busy executives that have three displays in front of them, right, from that standpoint, that can take in the view of their physician, but want more convenience to do care from behind their computer or at home?
There's no question about that. We all know telehealth has, the pandemic was a catalyst for telehealth. And I think we've seen a little bit of a dip coming out of it, but now we're starting to see it go back up. And along with that, we are now seeing about 4% of our patients that we generally see in a patient service center are now converting and are getting their labs drawn in their home. Mm-hmm. And that is on a sharp trajectory upwards as well. So I think we're looking at the future.
Yeah. Is it just, you know, you're looking at a blood draw or, you know, you and I have had conversations on this in the past. Once you get into the home, you know, you have the ability now to be the eyes and ears for, that's why I really think you have an opportunity here. And Susan does too. You become the eyes and ears of the virtual care, you know, teams that are out there. So they need somebody when they're walking in their home to maybe do a risk assessment, or they need to do a blood draw, or they need to do other things as well. You know, what kind of vision do you have as far as, you know, I'm not going to tell you to do proprietary information on this call, right? But what kind of vision are you envisioning that the consumers are asking for you to perform?
Yeah, I think that's where it's going. I mean, I think it's not just going in that direction, but it's going to be a multifaceted approach where we need to be able to provide diagnostic services in the patient's home, whether that's the lab draw or any other number of diagnostic services that might normally have been done in a brick and mortar setting. And I think that's one avenue. I think another avenue is actually looking at retail centers, Safeways, CVSs, Walmarts, and placing these systems in those locations. And then beyond that, looking at point of care devices in those locations, because there's some pretty cool tech coming down the pipe right now that is Theranos-like, but actually works. So if you remember, Theranos was the drop of blood that they had in Walgreens that was supposed to do everything. Didn't work. It was a great idea, though. The model was beautiful and it resonated with a lot of people. And now we're getting to a point where I'm not going to say we can do 100 tests off of a drop of blood, but we're getting to a point with a microfluidic specimen, we're going to be very close to be able to, you know, have a menu of maybe 30 or 40 tests that could potentially be done through microfluidics.
You mean Theranos, the company that took us back 4 or 5 years in trust and digital health, right? So, yeah, I've kind of heard that company before, right? So, and watched all the documentaries on it as well. Susan, let's go over to you really quickly and talk about, you know, adoption of technology by your patients or consumers or members or however you want to reference them. You know, are you finding that the people that want to enlist in your care, you know, are tech savvy, are becoming more tech savvy, or is the technology becoming easier for them to adopt and use? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, you know, I'd say it's a cross section, to be honest. I mean, some of our members have had plenty of access to technology and are pretty familiar with how to use it. But we have others that have absolutely never seen a smartphone in their lifetime, let alone a tablet, never interacted with an app, so have no idea what to do. With all that being said, I think we have all evolved to a point where technology is fairly simple and we can make it very simplistic for people to utilize. And you'd be amazed at the person who starts out saying, I never want to touch that. I want to keep it away from me. I don't want to have anything to do with it, to actually seeing it as an integral part of their life and how they can really engage with it and utilize it to support themselves in health. And part of health is just being able to engage and interact with other people in meaningful ways. So I find it that we've really come a long way in terms of helping people out.
So there's a couple of different statistics, which I'm sure you have around, you know, and you don't have to give me precise, but the members that decide not to engage, versus the ones that decide to engage with your team? How much of an impact do you make to that population by the ones that actively engage, right? And then the other one is, really quickly, is the ones that decide to engage, you know, from that perspective. How much are relying on your navigators as a one-on-one conversation? Like, I don't want to use technology, but I do want to talk to somebody. The versus the ones that want to use the technology and talk to your navigators.
You know, we make a huge impact in our members' lives. It's an interesting one of people who are engaged versus non-engaged. Of course, I'm not going to sit here and say 100% of everybody who's been enrolled in Catalytic is highly engaged. Obviously, they were engaged at some level, at some point, or they couldn't have engaged, you know, been enrolled in our services. But I would say, you know, overall, so I could say overall our population, we make a greater than 30% impact decrease in their costs over their prior year. So it's very significant. You know, we try to measure our lives based on, you know, impacts and outcomes. We make a tremendous difference in our members' outcomes. So more than 70% of our members have had a positive impact in their outcomes in the first year of engaging with us. I'd love that number to be higher, but the reality is things happen to us. And when we're really ill in the first place, we can have consequential comorbidities that occur, illnesses that happen, et cetera, along that journey. So that's just a really important one to keep in mind. So we're pretty excited about those impacts. You know, we have a net promoter score from our members of 88, which is, you know, pretty phenomenal, which I, again, think is a big indicator, not of just how much they enjoy our support and services, but how much better they're getting. We actually engage with our members to measure how much better they are getting. And more than 90% of our members say my health is tremendously better after working with Catalytic than it was before. And a lot of that, honestly, you know, you ask, is it one-to-one or is it through technology, is a combination of those things, right? Having access to information, which we push out through technology. We give them access to information through the tablets, so videos and supportive documents written very simply so that it's easy to consume at the layperson level to support them in their health and in their journey forward.
Yeah, I almost went in some regards over the last 15 years to do almost a placebo study, which is, you know, putting out the equipment, the technology, because we found and I've seen that if somebody is taking their readings, they're coming in on a regular basis, it really doesn't matter what those readings are sometimes. It's that if they're engaged to take their readings, they're more likely to take their medication, they're more likely to follow your instructions and stay out of the hospital, right? From that, the readings are important, obviously, to you, right? So you can look at trends as stuff are coming, but that engagement part is the big push, right? To try to get them engaged with you on a regular basis to follow your instructions, I assume, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I guess I'd also say, Kim, we take a different direction, right? We're not really trying to give people instructions. We're sitting with them, understanding their goals, and then helping them see how maybe taking their medications, you know, desire to pay attention to those readings, right? Look at their blood pressure and all, how it might allow them to live to their goals and what their life really is about. And I think that's a big step that's been missing sometimes in healthcare is we all assume that connection is made and that everybody understands that, well, if you keep your blood pressure under control and you don't have a stroke, of course, you might be able to spend more time with your grandchildren. But not always is that all those dots connected for somebody and them to see how those events come together. So sometimes it's really that simple.
Yeah. So how Tom, I'll get back to you in just a second, but how, you know, important is it sometimes to have a family member that is speaking on behalf of the rest of the family, potentially. I've seen that practice occur potentially in our Hispanic community here in especially in Arizona. So are there tools that you provide to the representative or to the family to help take care of the rest of the family members?
Yes, we use a very engaged approach, right? So we're really about, you know, again, our social side. So social determinants, we think as a social ecosystem, right? It's everybody participating. Where does everybody sit? Not just this one individual. You rise everybody up, not just one person, and that's more sustainable. So really engaging that family unit, Letting the family unit understand the impact to everyone. If this one person isn't doing well, how it impacts everyone, so that you really can elicit that support and get that, personal engagement to go up as the family unit. And whatever that may be defined as. So it might not be their blood family necessarily, but whatever that is that they're calling their family as a support.
Yeah, I love when we first started working with you, that one of the things you would say is, you know, when we walk into a home, you'd basically go through and say, you know, what do you need? What are your goals, right, down the road? What do you want today, right, to occur? Well, today I'm hungry. Well, let's feed you, right? Yeah. Right? Or, you know, I don't have a place to live that I feel safe in, secure in. Well, let's help you find, you know, another place that you're more secure in. So it's not just walking in with equipment, connecting them to a person and trying to monitor them for, you know, from a distance and then billing on remote monitoring codes out there. It's really trying to make a change, right, with the patient's life, right?
You bet. And change is done through engagement and relationships, right? Yeah. And I always say, again, we've broken healthcare by thinking that our titles give us some role and some opportunity to tell somebody what to do. It's really not about our titles. It's about engagement and trust. And we should all, you know, be hesitant to follow people just based upon letters behind a name. We should want to make sure that that person has our best interest at heart and that they've earned that trust. And so we work hard to build that.
That's great. Tom, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's beautiful. I mean, I couldn't agree more. Really, we had a comment the other day. It was made to one of our partners out there. That's just a phenomenal partner, a company called GetLabs that we work with. And the comment was, I can't remember the last time that somebody in healthcare was so happy to see me. You know, this was made by somebody that they went out and they searched that patient. They did a lab draw in that person's home. And that's what I think we all want to strive for, is that kind of relationship.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So, Tom, let's stay with you. The core of what we wanted to discuss today is, you know, new initiatives, or maybe it's already initiatives around underserved communities, especially here in Arizona. And we realize that, you know, we've got, you know, healthcare deserts that are out there where people don't have access to care. Right. Or they don't even have access to connectivity. What's Sonoran Quest's thoughts or initiatives to be able to help with, you know, those inequities?
Well, we do a lot of things, Ken. I mean, we are partnering with so many organizations out there, over 40 nonprofit organizations. My favorites are Aunt Rita's and Mission of Mercy, to whom we provide in-kind services and free testing. But we're also partnered with a lot of the ACOs that are out here. And we partner very strongly with many of the FQHCs to make sure that we have very good billing rates for those guys. And then they can pass that along to the underserved communities and those people that are vulnerable and that don't have insurance. Beyond that, right now, as I think I mentioned earlier, you know, we focus on being able to go out to patients' homes to collect those blood draws or send out test kits that those patients can do self-collections on themselves and then mail those kits back to us to get their hemoglobin A1C performed, for example. One of the things that's near and dear to my heart, though, is something that just happened. We have been lobbying along with AZ Bio to get a bill passed, HB 2144, I believe it is. That is a biomarker bill that gives parity for reimbursements throughout the system on any biomarker that provides clinical benefit. For example, I don't know how many of your listeners understand this, but a lot of times it's relatively easy to get CMS, Medicare, to approve and reimburse for a lab biomarker. There's steps that you have to go through to demonstrate clinical benefit, demonstrate clinical utility, and obviously validation studies of your assay. But once you have that, you're there. You either get a PLA code from CMS that allows you to bill for it, you're on their fee schedule, And you might think from there, it's all downhill, right? That Blue Cross and all the other payers would jump in line behind that, but they generally don't. And it can take 10 years for insurances to accept these new biomarkers and begin reimbursing for them. And in the meantime, you've got this inequity that's happening where some people can get the test and some people can't and have to pay out of pocket. And it's unfortunate because, some of these tests are incredibly important. Things like tumor profiling tests for cancer patients that can determine the best course of action for them. And now this bill was just passed on last Friday. Governor Ducey signed it into law. And starting January, this is going to give us equity across the state for any patient with any insurance. We'll have these biomarkers covered, which is just fantastic. And it's one of my, I think, maybe my greatest achievement that this has just happened. So I'm really excited about it.
That's awesome. Congratulations. One of the questions I was going to ask is, and this is actually going to be on an episode two weeks from now, but it's the role of big data, right, in healthcare. It's interesting. There are new algorithms for care that are emerging, based on all this data from the Metasphere and the EHR data and everything else with it. But we've got genomic data, we've got electronic health record data, and it becomes really super important to get, patient generated health data, right, from that. Do you find that people, or let's just take it down to the providers, do they trust data that's coming from the home, whether it's a user that is, or a member that is doing their own test to send it into Sonora, or it could be through solutions or devices that's coming from the home, or are they getting better at that?
I think they're getting better at that. I think, again, that's something that the pandemic has changed. I think people in their homes are getting more comfortable doing self-assessments and doing self-collections for these tests. I'll be honest, I don't know that it will ever be as good as getting a professional phlebotomist out to your home and drawing blood on yourselves. Some of these instruments that are point of care just aren't quite as accurate, but they're directionally very good. And that can give you some very good insights as to next steps that might need to be taken with that patient.
Yeah, I always say that, I don't think you're ever going to have Kent Dix doing a blood draw on himself, right? A venous draw. But there are companies out there that are taking, blood draws, blood draws from himself on the shoulder, sure. Right? And sending it into the lab. Is that starting to become a thing, right, in the industry where people can actually do blood draws?
It's starting to be a thing. That capillary, that unskilled draw is becoming more and more prevalent. I think it started with the simple finger stick testing, but honestly, finger stick testing is a little painful, and some people just don't like doing that. But there are companies out there like TAP, Seven Sense Biosystems, I think, is another one that have these devices that you slap on your arm, push a button. Completely painless, and they do that capillary blood draw and can give you 400 microliters of blood to send in, and works really well. It's run on the same instrumentation that we generally use for the venous blood draws, so it's very accurate.
Yeah, the one thing I love about that is that if they are actually sending in other physiological data by the same time, or they have an event, they can actually mark it and take the blood draw at the time of the event instead of having to wait to go to the doctor or to the lab, right? Which it could dissipate, right, from that standpoint out of the body. Absolutely. So I think that's, I think that's going to become an important factor going forward to giving greater access to care and to results as well. Now, I am going to stay with you just for a second and talk about COVID, right? So why I have you there, I was joking around, which is no joking matter about COVID, but a lot of people are just done with it. They want to be done with COVID, right? But it has its own mind. Where do you think we're at in the cycle, right, for COVID right now?
Oh my gosh.
That's a whole show. That's a whole show by itself, right?
Yeah, so. My crystal ball broke about a year ago on that, but I'll give you my best interpretation. I mean, we talk to a lot of really smart people on this, right? And they generally start talking about, you know, natural immunity and you know, vaccination immunity and how that could be waning in the coming months, and people aren't being as diligent to get their booster shots now because everybody's pretty much apathetic about it. But these variants are still coming.
Yeah.
And so if you talk to them, these people that are way smarter than me will say there's probably going to be another surge sometime in the fall. But then they also say, but it's anybody's guess.
Yeah.
But I happen to think that, you know, things might be lining up so that we do see some kind of a surge in the fall. And, but by the way, we're not here in Arizona. Our prevalence rate is not low right now.
Yeah,
I mean, it's above 12% consistently every day, which is not low.
You know? Yeah.
So we're kind of in a thing right now.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I just had one of my board members that was here 2 weeks ago. He flew up to Utah and he went to a conference with 900 people in a ballroom, and every person he knew came back with COVID after that. Wow. So, and they tracked it to that ballroom, right, as well. Now he's boosted, clear up to the booster, not the second booster. So his effects weren't as bad. Everybody's effects were like they just had the sniffle and the flu. Mm-hmm. But it's still there. It's still a thing, right? It's still kind of popping up, right, yeah, as well. So,
yeah. And it's going to be here. And it's, you know, it's endemic now.
Yeah.
We're just going to have to learn to live with it. And it's just going to be a part. I think, you know, before we started, I said, you know, I dedicate probably 12 to 15 hours a week still on COVID and what's the next thing for COVID and what are we doing now with COVID?
Right.
And, you know, the rest of my time, I get to work on the new cool stuff, but I've still got that hum in the back of my head that's labeled COVID that I have to pay attention to.
Yeah. I want to come back to the cool stuff here in a second, but Susan, you know, let's go to the heart of your expertise as well. And that is, you know, rural areas, underserved communities, but let's just talk about connectivity, right? From that standpoint, I mean, how hard is it for you still to reach the four corners of Arizona and, you know, and around certain areas to try to connect to your patients? And if you can't get connectivity, what's your alternative to it?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because we do serve a large portion of the areas where there's zero connectivity. I mean, when you're talking about areas with no internet service provider anywhere and no cell signal, no matter, you know, what cell phone company you're working with, it's a definite decrease in access to care for these individuals. So, you know, in our model, we're driving to them, we're going to see them, trying to make sure they get access to the services. And it's really, I'd say, a fairly manual process, to be honest with you. That, you know, we go out, drive out to see them, figure out what they need, take everything we can think of. So to Tom's point, you know, what are all the point of care testing devices that we can take with us? You know, knowing the member because we see them longitudinally, you know, what else is it that they may need that we carry out with us? But then driving back to where there is some connectivity to be able to connect with the rest of the ecosystem to say, okay, now how do we get this person from this rural place to the care that they need? And you know, that need, it's an interesting when you really go in and dig into what is needed, because they often don't have transportation that is sufficient to get to the next level of care that they may need. And so, you know, all the way down to us coordinating and ensuring that they have the transportation there, the connectivity there, and that we are then going to wherever they are at to ensure that they have the support that they need to get to share their story and to get the care that they are needing, because their family may be left behind in that circumstance and not able to go with them. And as you mentioned about COVID, right, we still have all the restrictions that go into place that can sometimes limit that support.
Yeah. So you also do work with part of your members are homeless, right, as well. And are they on the street? Are they in shelters from that? Is it a variety? And if people are on the street or in shelters, how do you get access to care through using technology, right? From that standpoint, I've found really, you know, from working previously, that, you know, people are human, right? And so if you give them a nice shiny tablet, you know, it may disappear, right? On the street, somebody may take it, right? Or they may have to sell it to be able to make a meal, right? From that as well. Are you able to, you know, put technology out there and people use it?
Absolutely. So over 20% of our population is homeless in a range of locations, right? Whether it be the street, in shelters, but shelters are transient in nature, right? I mean, by definition, you're not supposed to be there long periods of time. So they have to run, you know, move back and forth between that. We provide them with tablets just as we do everyone else. And what you'll find is, again, sometimes they're attacked and the tablet's taken away from them, right? Because it has some value. Maybe they have to sell it. We try to make sure our members aren't in a circumstance where they need to sell their tablet for food. We try to make sure they have food so that that's not the case. But they'll also use those devices to stay connected. They see it as a lifeline. How can I get connected to the person I need? We pay for the connectivity. We try to help make sure that they have devices to charge them. Because plugging your device in isn't even easy, right? So you need mobile chargers that are solar in nature, those types of things. And we provide that for our members to help them and support them along that journey. You have to also be cognizant that they can only carry so much, right? So you're not giving them a blood pressure cuff and all of those things because it's too heavy and it weighs things down and takes up too much space. But if they can at least have connectivity to us, then we can get to them and support and help them and, you know, do that care at the site of wherever they may be. So whether that is on the street or in the park or at a shelter, we service all of those areas.
You kind of answered this already, but I want to be more succinct with it. You know, what do you believe is the best tool in your bag to be able to have the greatest outcome with a patient? I know there's not a one fit size fits all, but, you know, is it a combination of the navigator with technology? Is it, have you found, you know, some great, you know, tool that's out there in the marketplace that gives you data that you need to be able to work with patients? Is it incentives, right, for people to be able to, you know, work towards a reward or a goal? What do you think is the best tool in your arsenal?
Yeah, I think the best tool in the arsenal is really that engagement and, you know, no judgment, just show up to accept you as a human being. We're all human. And how do I create that trust and engagement? Technology is an important component because we need to have the information and the data to support our care as we go forward and be able to share it across the system for everybody to have access to that. But I'd say it's secondary to the engagement and to the humans who work for us, making that engagement real.
Tom, that's great, Susan. Tom, really quickly, when you're looking, you know, across the horizon with new initiatives that you're working on with Sonora and Quest, you know, you talked about some of the new innovations that are coming down the pike. What excites you as far as new innovations that, you know, are coming that we should all be, you know, excited about?
I think we're looking at new technology, new testing. I'm just going to stay with biomarkers right this second. New technology that allows us to have less invasive draws or do diagnostics less invasively. And specifically, I'm referring to testing that might now be done through cerebral spinal fluid to try and identify amyloid plaque in the brain, for example, which is a precursor to Alzheimer's. And that's obviously a very risky procedure. Nobody likes a lumbar puncture, especially as a screening test. But now we are able to do that through looking at just blood. Previously, it's such a small amount that's in your blood that it's almost undetectable. But because of new technologies and new methodologies, we're able to now pick that up and quantify it. And it correlates extremely well with much more expensive PET scanning of the brain. So I think that's one thing. There's also new technology out there that is using next-gen sequencing to look at skin tags or pigmented lesions. And so instead of actually doing a biopsy on a concerning lesion, you're able to just take a sticker, put it on the lesion, pull it off, and send that to the lab to get next-gen sequencing run on it to determine whether or not it's malignant. which is incredibly important because right now about 90% of the skin lesion, the skin biopsies that are done are negative. So you just got a pretty invasive procedure done and it's negative. Thank God it's negative, but could you have done that better? And so there are a lot of new tests that are out there like that, that we're very excited about at Sonora Quest.
Do you guys do any type of genomic testing at all? Is that in your,
We do we do solid tumor profiling, for example, for cancer patients to help determine the best treatment options for them. That's one of those tests right now that isn't well reimbursed across the spectrum of insurances, and that's why I think a bill like 2144 that is now law is just going to be. I hate to use the term game changer because I think it constantly gets overused, but boy, I'm thinking that's a game changer.
Yeah, we and congratulations on getting the bill passed as well. I think that's a huge initiative. That we've also looked at the expanded role of pharmacists and what they're playing, you know, in the space as well. It doesn't have to be just a PharmD, but you know, a pharmacist being able to deliver, you know, at least eyes and ears in rural communities or in underserved communities as well. You know, they could take. I don't know if a PharmD can do a blood draw. I don't know if that's possible or not. But they definitely, but they definitely can go through and monitor, you know, a patient and maybe make a on behalf of the PCP and make a recommendation back to it. And I think 35 states now have got pharmacists that have provider status, right, to be able to do that. So you talked about going into retail, you know, facilities like Safeway. I mean, Safeway was one of the pioneers for Theranos, right, from that standpoint.
No, and there are Safeway. You're right.
Safeway too. Yeah, Safeway and Walgreens both. And that's a different story, a different time, right? But what is your thinking as far as going into the retail drug chains? You would have a phlebotomist that's in, you know, in their clinics that are there?
Phlebotomist or a medical assistant. I think I like the initial idea of using a pharmacist or a pharm tech. I think the concern that I have with that is, number one, pharmacists are in high demand right now. We've seen that at CVS, for example. CVS is a partner of ours that is doing COVID testing, doing the collections for us right now. And they have had to downsize that model because the pharmacists, they just don't have enough pharmacists. Or, you know, every time you have somebody who's watching somebody do a collected nasal swab, there are opportunity costs to that, right? What else could that pharmacist be doing? Because they're probably not working at the top of their certification if they're doing an observed collection or they're gathering information that somebody, you know, like a technician or a medical assistant could be doing. So you're paying a pretty high dollar amount to have somebody do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to consider those opportunity costs when you look at a model like that. And so I like the idea. I love the idea of putting it into a retail location because that's where people are going anyway, right? So if you look back 15 years ago, we were putting all of our patient service centers in medical office buildings. And you had to always go back to the place where the doctor was to have your fasting blood drawn. Boy, what a pain that was, right? It would have been so much nicer if you could have gone to the grocery store and had it done. And that's what we're doing now.
Right. Or show up in front of my house and a little Prius that comes in and takes a blood draw, right? Instead from that. Just like Grubhub and all that stuff where I'm too lazy to go McDonald's a mile down the road, right? I want it to come to me instead, right? And I'm willing to pay for it. So,
that's right.
Yeah. So Susan, let's go back to you really quickly. We're almost out of time from this. And I really want you to talk a little bit about William Jack School and the initiative you're doing with them. It's once a year that at least we get involved with that with you, that we have the privilege to do it. But tell me about that program and what you're doing with William Jack.
Yeah, so we have long had an initiative with William Jack. And thank you, Kent, and the Live 365 team for joining us in that event, where we provide Christmas to the families of that school who otherwise will not be able to have Christmas. And that is a little bit different than most people think in terms of adopting someone for Christmas. So where you might adopt an angel off of a tree and buy a gift because it says on there, I want a truck. We actually left the children and their families. So the parents and everybody included to provide what their clothing sizes are, their shoe sizes, and three things that they would like to receive for Christmas. And then we have partners like Kent and the Life 365 team and others. So our friends, family members, all kinds of people coming together who then take those families, adopt them, provide them with the gifts on their list. It's game changing. It's life changing to families to receive that and to have that opportunity. And we do it again in a format where we're all in the cafeteria at the school, and the people who adopted the family get to meet the family who's actually receiving the gifts. And they get to sit with the children and their families as they open those gifts and to see their lives changed, and sometimes change forever. I know Kent's heard me tell this story before, but, you know, I always dress up. And one year I was dressed up as Mrs. Santa, and a little boy comes racing up to me and says, "Mrs. Santa, Mrs. Santa." And I said, "Yes, what's going on?" And he said, "Nobody will ever be able to make fun of me again because I have Nike tennis shoes now." Mm. And that's the difference you make in someone's life. And that's what I think, you know, about healthcare is when you sit down and you're willing to listen and engage with someone, you're able to make a difference in their lives. And this Christmas event is just one more extension of that, of you listened, you heard what somebody told you that they'd like to have, and you changed their life.
Yeah, that's what I love about the program. It's just an extension, really, of you and what your view is on Catholic Health Partners and the community, because you're taking care of the family, you know, behaviorally and also physically, right, from that standpoint. But you're also going deeper into it to make sure the kids are fine from that perspective, because they also need to be taken care of from a standpoint, because they are all the navigators for their family, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole family is getting actually healed at the same time to become a unit. It's been a real blessing to actually see that, because you see families where they've lost the mother, right? Or they've lost the father, right? From that. And there's key members that are missing from the family, but the kids actually have taken on, as youngsters, have taken on immense responsibility for that family. And to do something for them, I think, is just brilliant on your part. The one thing that blew me away is the love and support by even the principal, right, of the school, right? This man treats the children like they're his own, right? It's not a job. So anyway, I'm going to put some information, you know, on the website and on the video about this event. It's not too early for you guys to think about, you know, getting involved next year or this year, sorry, at the end of this year. And Susan will be putting some information out about it as well. So I'm going to cut us off right now. And I want to thank both of you guys for, you know, a great show, right, from a great episode. And I'm sure there's going to be people that are going to want to connect with you and get some additional information. But I want to thank everybody for attending this evening, and thank, you know, Tom and Susan for participating and providing your great insights. We'll post the recording on the New Normal website later today. Our next episode will be the emergence of the payvider, getting closer to the patient, next week on May 18th with Lee Shapiro, one of the founders of Livongo and now Transcarin and Seven Wire Ventures. And Dr. David Ru, Global Chief Medical Officer of Microsoft. He was also with Samsung prior to that. So it should be a great show just like this one. I want to hope you will join us for that. And you can register and find details on newnormal.buzz. So thank you, everybody, for attending, and have a great evening.
Thank you.
Thanks guys. Thank you. Tom. Thanks, Susan.
Okay.